What I'd like to do is say two things about my friend and colleague Nama and not present a really academic introduction, which is perhaps too well known to recite here. But in any case, yeah, you see the relationship we have. What I'd like to say is two things about Nama. One is about our friendship and collegial relationship. The first time we met was the summer of 2008. The first thing she offered was to set me up with contacts from the excavations at Ashkelon, which worked perfectly for research I was performing. The second thing was the suggestion that we begin this late antiquity workshop. And so the genesis of this collegial interaction between two colleges, two departments, is entirely due to Nama's own generous spirit and collegial sense. And the other thing I want to say, because I never get to say that in public, and if I were to say it when Nama was able to stop me, I would never even gotten to the second sentence. The second thing I want to say is that even though she's listed as assistant professor in the call for the lecture, in fact, Nama is on the edge of ascending the next rung of the ladder to the untouchable rank of associate professor as of September 1st. And I think that should be recognized, that it is all but a done deal. And so without anything more to say, because she won't let me, I will now hand over the podium to Nama. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm here today because Glenn made me. As you may know, I'm a linguist, so I get to be fairly technical usually, but Glenn asked me to talk about my work, and I quote as if we were a five-year-old. So I will try to do that, and I ask you guys that to stop me in the middle of my talk if you feel that something I say is unclear. I made a handout, Glenn, which I hope is clear. I tried to make it for five-year-olds. Okay, so Aramaic is a branch of Semitic attested from about the 9th, 8th century BCE until today. It was a major means of communication in the Near East from its earliest attestation. Here are two steles from the some of the most ancient texts in Aramaic. Nerab is dated to the end of the 8th century, and it was found close to Aleppo in Syria. And Zakor is dated to the beginning of the 8th century and also was found in Aleppo. After the rise of the Achaemenid Empire in 500 BCE, Aramaic was used as the lingua franca and the medium of written edicts of the empire, with attestations in every corner of the empire, including China. Now, I can't really give you dates for these, but you can see a stronger law written with Chinese character. So these are inscriptions from China. Aramaic texts from late antiquity are numerous and essentially divide into two major dialectal branches or dialects. Western dialects, which are essentially various dialects spoken in Palestine, and Eastern dialects spoken in Syria and Mesopotamia. The latter group includes Mandean. This is a written text in Mandean of the Mandean sect, if you know something about it, and it's spoken until today, although speakers are kind of dying in droves, and it will probably be extinct in about 15 years. Jewish, Babylonian, Aramaic, which is the language of the Babylonian Talmud, the language of the Palestinian or Jerusalem Talmud is a Western dialect. So this is Jewish, Babylonian, Aramaic. The Talmud and other texts are considered part of this dialect. And of course, Syriac, my true love, and the language I will be teaching in the fall. Syriac has been the object of much interest by scholars of early Christianity for the wealth of the material about the development of Christianity in the region, and by scholars of Semitic, since it's one of the earliest attestations of vocalized Aramaic. And in this talk today, I will discuss a little Aramaic particle that I believe has been misunderstood, and I will try to show you why you should care about it even if you're not linguists. So my aim is to show you basically how important it is to know a language well, even if you're not a linguist, but more broadly, to lure you into my Syriac class in the fall. So before getting into the issue itself, I want to give you a little prologue about the linguistic context of what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk a little bit about speech and marking speech in texts. And generally, there are two types of speech. There are plenty of types of speech, but just to make it simple, there's direct speech and indirect speech. They're marked differently in linguistic means. And you can see on your handout under A, in English, for example, indirect speech is marked as dependent on the verb of speech. So he always maintained that he is innocent. That is a very common way of doing this in languages of the world. And then direct speech, where you have two essentially independent utterances, he claims, I am innocent. So except marking certain the indirect speech as dependent, there are other ways of seeing differentiating these types of speech. For example, indirect speech there's no change of reference, so you can see third person, while direct speech shows change of reference from third to first person. There's also types of verbal forms, so indirect speech usually can use infinitives, while direct speech uses things like imperatives and kind of vocatives and stuff like that. So that's kind of the background of what I'm talking about. So from now on, the examples on your handout, you'll see that I marked some things as blue and the particle I'm going to talk about in red. The blue marks speech. Okay, so whatever is blue is part of a speech, not the main sentence. Okay, so the Aramaic particle lam occurs in Egyptian Aramaic, a dialect of the Achaemenid Empire spoken by Jews in an Egyptian island, which is today Aswan, and Syriac. This is another picture from that area, excavations of the Jewish temple and texts from the Aramaic texts from that area. It is traditionally described as a particle used to introduce direct speech. Somewhat, but not really, similar to English quaff in crazy text from far away. So you can see in example one on your handout, we have the verb to say, aleph mim la. So I will not be able to say to you, lam, and then speech. Okay. So that's essentially what people assume, what scholars assume, is the typical function of this particle. Several prominent scholars argued that this particle is either identical to the use of the infinitive of the verb to say, that you see on example one, or directly derived from it. So either there's functional similarity or there's actual etymological connection between them. The background for this claim is the obvious similarity between the verb to say and the particle lam. So lam has lam mim, and also the infinitive of the verb to say has lam mim. With some reductions and phonological changes, you can get something there. So that's one reason. The other reason is that Hebrew, which is a close relative of Aramaic, also uses the infinitive of the verb to say to do exactly that, to introduce direct speech. So you can see that in three. It's a biblical Hebrew example, vayevarech otam Elohim le'emor, and then two imperatives, direct speech. Okay, and there's no need to translate this infinitive. It's just a marker of direct speech, like the claim for lam. There's no meaning for this particle. It's just a marker of direct speech. So this seems like a case closed kind of thing, right? Very convincing. We have, on the one hand, Jews using this biblical Hebrew particle, and on the other hand, a very easy phonological connection between them. However, if you start collecting all the occurrences of this particle from the texts and looking at the context of where they occur, things start to become really quite different. I'm going to start examining examples from Egyptian Aramaic, from these texts from Elephantine, and then move to Syriac. So in both of these languages, both of these dialects, both of them use inflected forms of the verb to say to introduce speech, which again is very, very common in all the languages that we know here. So we assume that if lam, this particle, is really introducing direct speech, it will be in the same position where we expect the verb to say, right? So at the beginning of the speech, introducing direct speech. But the majority of the examples in Egyptian Aramaic, in them, lam either does not appear as introducing direct speech. For example, you can see in 5, right? You can see that the direct speech starts at least two words before lam, so it's not introducing the speech, right? So it's either not introducing speech, or there is an obvious verb of speech, and lam is redundant. Example 2 could be such an example. There are also many examples where there's no speech act at all. So example 6, for example, is in the text, the story of Achikar, and Achikar is telling things in first person about himself, about his adventures, what happened to him, and he also says this, "I was afraid." There's no speech, no one is quoting, unless you're saying he's quoting himself, which he is not. So lam is just there with no connection to speech. In Egyptian Aramaic, out of the entire corpus, I counted 34 examples of lam, and only 3 examples behave like the one you see in example number 1. Only 3 examples. In 3 examples, lam appears before the quote, before the direct speech. Okay, so we can look at additional information from something called the Bistun inscription. This is an inscription from Iran of today that also has an Aramaic translation. The Bistun inscription was commissioned by Darius shortly after his coronation in 522 BCE. It contains the same text in 3 languages: Old Persian, which is an Indo-Aryan language; Elamite, which is a language isolate; and Babylonian, which is a dialect of Akkadian, a Semitic language. For many years, scholars assumed that the Aramaic text found in Elephantine is a translation of the Babylonian text, the Babylonian text on the mountain. It's probably not exactly that, but it is a translation of the Babylonian text. So why does that matter? Because in Babylonian, there is a particle that introduces direct speech. It's pronounced umma, U-M-M-A, and indeed it's not translatable, it's just a marker of direct speech. So if the Aramaic lam introduces direct speech, we would expect it to translate umma in Babylonian, right? It makes sense. You have umma, you have lam, they have exactly the same function, voila. And indeed there is one example, in fact the only example of lam in this text, in this dialect, in Egyptian Aramaic, in this translation, translates umma. So you can see 7. In 7a is the Akkadian text, and you can see he ordered blah, 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 umma, and then two imperatives, right? Go kill. And the same in B in the Aramaic. He sent one man, blah, 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 lam, go kill. 2 imperatives. Okay, so great. However, Akkadian uses additional 35 sentences with umma. So 35 other instances of umma occur in this text. None of them is rendered with lam. Lam occurs only once, okay? Only in this example that I showed you. So we would expect some kind of connection. And in fact, Aramaic, if it uses something to refer to this, they use the verb to say, and you can see in 8, we have the Akkadian first, I gave orders, umma, again, 2 imperatives, go defeat, go kill. And then you look at Aramaic, B, I said, go kill, imperatives. No lam, no nothing, just the verb to say, inflected verb to say. Okay, so that doesn't actually help. I mean, it does show us that it's not exactly the same. The distribution doesn't really support the common assumption that lam is introducing direct speech. But the connection to the infinitive, to say, looks so convincing. So what can we do with that? Well, here's the problem. I can use this. Okay, we have this, supposedly, we get this, right? You see that, I think, in 4. So from this to get to this, we have to assume a lot of phonological changes, a lot of reductions, R dropping, blah, blah, right? And so this doesn't take 2 days, right? So we need to assume that this infinitive was attested or existed long time before we get this, right? Before Egyptian Aramaic, perhaps, was came to be, right? I'll give you an example from English. The word in English by, B-Y-E, right, started out as a full sentence, and you can see that under 9, right? It was God be with you. It took at least 300 years for it to become B-Y-E, right? 300 years. So we expect some, not maybe 300 years, but some passing of time to create this from this, if it existed. But the infinitive lemo is only attested in Egyptian Aramaic. It's not attested before Egyptian Aramaic, and it's not attested after Egyptian Aramaic. So when exactly did all of this happen? There's no time for it for this processes to happen. So some scholars say, well, fine. So, you know, these are Jews. They borrowed the infinitive from Hebrew, that infinitive that we saw on in example 3. Okay, so there are problems with that too. When we look at the Aramaic cachet, the text that we get from Elefantini, there are no Hebrew texts from that. Sure, they're Jews, but that doesn't mean that they spoke Hebrew, right? There are no Hebrew texts there, and there are no Hebrew words in the text that they do use. The Aramaic text that they write, they don't use Aramaic Hebrew words. Now, what we know about Jewish dialects, or variants of dialects that Jews spoke, Judeo-Arabic, Jewish German, Yiddish, and other forms, they all have a set of a large part of their vocabulary, and not only a large part, but also a predictable part of their vocabulary is Hebrew, is based on Hebrew. That is not the case with these texts. They have no Hebrew. So there are no Hebrew texts. What we find is hieratic and demotic, and later on Coptic and Greek in that area. No Hebrew. Now also we need to remember that the Jews in Egypt is exactly the community that that commissioned the translation of the Bible to Greek, the Septuagint. So they obviously did not know Hebrew. Now for something that for a feature that is essentially morphosyntactic, to move from one language to another, we expect some serious connection between these languages. So either some kind of heavy language teaching as part of the education of these people. For example, what's going on with classical Arabic for speakers of other non-Arabic dialects in the Muslim world today, or a form of diglossia, which means that they spoke one language, for example, Aramaic, and primarily wrote in another language, for example, Hebrew. And that will maybe account for movement of features in the written language. But again, that is not what we have. We have no evidence that they could write Hebrew or that they could understand Hebrew. It's very, very unlikely that Hebrew is involved in any way. Okay, so that's this dialect. When we come to Syriac, the difficulty with the whole direct speech hypothesis becomes even more acute, because in Syriac we have endless supply of examples, and there it's quite clear that it's not exactly that. So there are two approaches, two ways to say what it does. One of them is still to insist that it marks direct speech, and other things are either later innovations or we'll make them sound like they're direct speech. And another is to say that it actually introduces quotations, primarily biblical quotations, obviously plenty of those in Syriac. So let's look if this actually has any evidence for it. So the earliest text in which Lam appears in Syriac, the earliest Syriac text, is the Peshitta New Testament, which you can see one example in 10. There are only 2 examples in the Peshitta New Testament of Lam. You see one here, and there's another one, a second letter for thistle or something. So this is peculiar by itself, because given the amount of biblical quotations in the New Testament, you'd expect plenty of limes everywhere, and there are only two. So that's one problem. The other problem is that if we look at the Peshitta Old Testament, lam is not used at all. Now, remember that I told you that in Hebrew we use le'emor as a particle to introduce direct speech? You'd assume that lam would be used for that, at least somewhat. It's not at all. It's not attested at all. I have a whole theory that these are actually different dialects, but it doesn't matter. The fact is that lam is not attested in the earliest texts in Syriac. When we move to non-translated texts, clear, clean, classical Syriac, lam seems not to be restricted to speech. I'll give you an example here in 11. This is from a collection of short stories by Bar Hebraeus. So this one is about two monks, and it tries to tell stories about how devout and how pristine they were. They wouldn't let any woman come close to them. So the story says, Father Pumon and his brother, when their mother, Lam, came to see them, they wouldn't let her come into their cell. No speech, nothing. It's just there in the middle of the sentence. It's not a quotation. There's no quotation in this. It's just a story about two monks and how insane they are. So that doesn't work. In other examples, there are actually clear markers of speech. For example, the verb to say, or the relative particle de in Syriac. So you can see that in, I believe, 12. So I said to him, de, and then direct speech, right? There's lam there, but there are actual markers before that. Now, at the beginning of my talk, I explained about direct and indirect speech, and I said that direct speech is usually independent, right? It's not marked as dependent on the verb of speech. Syriac doesn't make that distinction. Syriac marks every type of speech with the relative pronoun. Okay, it sounds really weird to us, but that's what it does. It just doesn't make that distinction. Okay. So we see an example where it actually marks speech with its regular means, and then lam appears there. Of course, it also does that without, as you can see in 13, it can do that without lam. Lam is not necessary to mark speech in Syriac. What is necessary is the verb to speak, or some form of a verb that communicates information, and the relative pronoun. This is what you need to mark speech, not lam. And even in texts which use, in texts that have that introduce quotations, biblical quotations, lam may appear, but it's not necessarily part of the quotation, and it doesn't necessarily introduce it. So in 14, we have there is lam, no one, and then a quotation, right, from Isaiah. So lam is not part of the quotation. It's not introducing. It doesn't introduce the quotation. It's just in the vicinity of the quotation. So in both Syriac and Egyptian Aramaic, the syntax and distribution of lam are quite similar. It appears in direct speech and non-speech environments. And the only place that Syriac uses lam that maybe Egyptian Aramaic not so much is biblical quotation, just because there are no biblical quotations in Aramaic of Elephantine. But it's not obligatory there either. So what do we do with this? It doesn't do what it's supposed to do. And there's not all the evidence is not enough to conclude that it has a single function. So the question is, what to do with this, and why should you care? Well, what I think lam does in these texts is mark this text, the utterance that it's introduced in or that it's placed in, as information that the speaker has high confidence in. This is a fancy linguistic term for this, but it doesn't matter. What matters is that when you read a text and there's lam there, it means that the speaker thinks that it's not only very important, but it's also something that he believes is complete truth. right? This is consistent with all the examples that I gave you, and others, of course. So it's consistent with utterances that the speaker says about themselves, like six that Achikau says about himself. Statements like the example in two, or biblical quotations like example 14. So this is not some random marker with no meanings that just marks a grammatical function, but rather an important tool in understanding what speakers think about text and how they perceive the truthfulness of what they say. So people who are not linguists may not care about the etymology of this particle, whether it comes from the verb to say or not. And maybe it's not important, but what is important is that we need to know that language is like the back of our hands to understand, to really understand and grasp what these people are saying. And that's basically what I wanted to say.